Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, roll up again for the Gig Stories podcast with me, Alex, and my beautiful Scottish friend, Christopher Payne. How are you, lovely man?
I'm okay. And I realize you said again there. The reason for that are twofold. The first fold is that we're here again. We have been here before, and we're now here again. And the second thing is...
You're going to tell them, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to tell them. Yeah. We've already recorded this intro, but for the first time in about 40-odd episodes, neither of us pressed record.
Which was great. It was great. And I'll be honest, friend, we were just chatting about the end. We were doing the outro of the podcast, and Christoph realised we'd not press record.
Yeah.
So we've had a lovely chat with each other.
It's been gorgeous.
And so if you missed it, never mind.
Nah, well, I've forgotten what we said anyway, so we might as well just crash on. I don't know. I mean...
And do you know what we said? Because it was a nice question. I had obviously, you know what my brain's like now, and we went off on a Scottish one because I mentioned the word Scottish as I was introducing you in the podcast, and I instantly, my brain went, it's Burns night next week. I mean, is that related to the podcast? No, not really. But I asked you a question about Burns night, which led us talking to about St. David's Day. And in Wales, we have celebrations that rely heavily on music. There's lots of poetry, dancing. And I was wondering if you had something similar in Scotland. And then to cut a longer story even shorter, I said, and I will check after this, it'd be hilarious if I have just lied and made this up.
Yeah.
But there's just something in the back of my head that makes me think I saw the Mannix play live on a St. David's Day.
Yeah.
Now, if I haven't, that is absolutely the kind of thing they would do. So who knows?
It should be pretty straightforward to check, because you could go to setlist.fm or whatever that website
absolutely
is and check that out.
I'll see if I can do it for the outro, and then we can that just made laugh at my lies.
Yeah, but that made me think, and listener, maybe you can have a look through your ticket collection, if you have one, or your Excel spreadsheet of gigs, and just have a look, see if you've been to a gig on a notable date. So we did mention New Year's Eve, Hogmanay, but that's, you know, there's normally a big gig kicking about on that date. But the example
99,
I gave,
I said 1999, where
99.
The millennium, I definitely was watching the Mannix.
Right. Okay. Well, I mentioned the 31st of October, and I think it was 1998. So Halloween, and the band I went to see, they started with a version of Halloween, the theme music from Halloween, and it was at the Barrowlands in Glasgow, and it was Daft Punk, and it was absolutely banging.
That's such a belter.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm wondering if you went to see, did you see Green Day on July the 4th, or, you know, I don't know.
Oh, really?
Yeah, maybe.
Green Day on July the 4th.
Did you see Arcade Fire on Bonfire Night? Do you know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know. So yeah, have a think, have a look through your ticket collection, and if you went to a gig on a specific notable date, not just like your birthday, that's of no interest to us.
I don't know. That's quite interesting to me, because I have a rubbish birthday. It was last week.
Yeah.
And so I
forgot about it. I'm so sorry.
Fine. It's fine. You.
I did say why. I mean, I found a very good quick weight loss program, and it's called Getting Norovirus, right? So that's
horrible.
My excuse. That's why I didn't wish you happy birthday until I was
stuff.
Prompted.
But I would love to go and see a good gig on my birthday, but January the 10th, there just aren't any gigs around. Generally.
No.
So yes, I would love to know if anyone's seen that. I'm gonna find yours hard to beat, to be honest. Go and see Daft Punk, and they play the theme from Halloween.
Yeah.
On Halloween. That's good. Anyway, let's move on, because this is a wonderful episode. What a guest. A genuine musical and DJing royalty. DJ Paulette. And she has a book coming out. And she was so kind enough to give us some time. And I could have spoken to her for hours. Now, if you are not completely au fait with Paulette, then do not fear. You are going to learn an awful lot in this next hour or so. And we would urge you to buy her book. Tell us a bit more about the book there, Chris, because Chris, old fancy pants over there, has got a lovely advanced copy, haven't you?
An advanced proof copy, no less. Woo-hoo! Of Welcome to the Club, The Life and Lessons of a Black Woman DJ. And rather than just giving a rough idea of what it's about, I'll just read the back of it. Which does it far better than I could. Welcome to the Club. Manchester legend DJ Paulette shares the highs, lows, and lessons of a 30-year music career with help from some famous friends. One of the Hacienda's first female DJs, DJ Paulette has scaled the heights of the music industry, playing to crowds of thousands all around the world. Here she tells her story, offering a remarkable view of the music industry from a Black woman's perspective. Behind the core values of peace, love, unity and respect, dance music is a world of exclusion, misogyny, racism and classism. But, as Paulette reveals, it is also a space bursting at the seams with powerful women. DJ Paulette is an award-winning DJ whose 30-year career has seen her play some of the world's greatest parties, from Manchester's Hacienda to Ibiza Rocks and the Ministry of Sound. It's an absolute cracker.
She's just amazing. And we had the loveliest time with her, and I think you're really gonna enjoy it. So Chris, take it away.
Well, yeah, I don't think there's much more to say apart from
Nope. Here
is our conversation with DJ Paulette.
So we are with Paulette. Do people call you DJ? Or just Paulette? Or DJ Paulette? Or
they call me Paulette or DJ Paulette. And my nephews and nieces, when they're in the green room coming to a party that I put them on the guest list for, will call me Auntie Paulette all the way across the club. Which I think is kind of pretty cool because it's a different... No, they're not little, but it's a respect thing in Jamaica. In Jamaica, you call people by first name, last name,
but it's so funny, specifically auntie, having very, the DJ.
Yeah, in front. It's there on purpose, though.
It's there on purpose.
So. I don't use my surname for work at all, ever. If anyone ever puts my surname on any publicity, any flyer,
you
anything.
Get it off.
They will meet the wrath of me.
Because I'd met years ago DJ Shadow.
Yeah.
And I had no clue. I had this conversation walking towards him before we said hello, thinking, what do I call him? DJ?
Shadow?
DJ Shadow? Shads?
Yeah.
Shadow? Mr. Shadow? Mr.
Yeah.
DJ the Shadow?
Yeah.
And when you have DJ in front of something, I'm like, oh, I don't know. Do I call you DJ Paulette?
Or did you call him by his real name?
I know, Margaret. Mike. Yeah. I was like, do I call him Mike? Is that too...
Yeah, yeah, because with some of the DJs, it's like, it's not their real name, but for me, it's just like, it's my real name, so you just call me Paulette.
Yeah, but you also mentioned in the
book...
But
the DJ is there specifically. I've kept it, not because I hope people remember that I've played records in the club, but it has a very specific tactical reason.
I like
that. When they do lineups, if it's not in order of, you know, in the hierarchy of great DJ, you know, uber mega superstar goes first, which they do anyway.
Yeah.
So you get like three bands, but within whatever band I'm in, once it goes to alphabetic, the DJ puts me at the top.
Yeah. That is so funny. That is so funny.
That brings us to the book, because I loved that.
Yeah.
I loved that, and you mentioned that in the book. And,
yeah.
And when we...
As a throwaway comment.
Yeah, absolutely. But it stuck with me, and I thought, yeah, you're not daft. That's a good plan.
Well, it's funny, because I sort of had this kind of conversation with, I'm sure you know, LTJ Bookham.
Yeah.
Because LTJ is French, isn't it? Basically for the DJ. So, which is hilarious. And again, when I met him, I wasn't sure. What do I call him? DJ LTJ Bookham? No. LTJ Bookham? Yeah. Danny?
Yeah.
What do I call him?
Just call him Danny.
Anyway, we've jumped in there.
So, when we initially wanted to get you on, didn't know about the book. This has been completely
long
independent of the
coming,
book. And
okay.
then. And then
you've been on our list for ages.
Yeah, yeah. And so finally, when we managed to get it together, you said,
Shall I send you
a copy of the book? I'm like, yes, please, lovely. And so it's a really nice bit of kind of cosmic ordering that we're here. And also, we're here in home, we're on the second floor of home. And I realised last week that...
Yeah, this is where I'm doing my launch party.
You're doing the launch.
And it's also one of the places where I used to DJ when I started DJing in bars around Manchester. And I call it the bear cage, because they used to put food through the grills. But I think it's on the floor below.
It's the second floor, yeah.
And the DJ booth is above the bar. And it, like, the back of the booth is like that open grills.
Okay.
And it's got a door. And so people are like, how did she get there?
And
so behind you is a stairwell, basically. Yeah.
Yeah, and behind me is the stairwell. So I'm like, well, there's a door.
It didn't climb.
I love that.
I didn't just shimmy up on a cable. Like, you know, what do they call that? Climbing.
Like a climbing wall
or something. No, I kind of
that
went
was obviously
up the stairs,
all planned that we came
went
here for
up
that.
The stairs and got in the booth. And like when you DJ in bars, that like you're allowed to get drinks and food and that, and they'd like knock on the grill and like, here's your pizza or here's your salad, and they'd be feeding me through the bars. I'm like, just open the door.
Well, I realised that I've photographed, so I'm a photographer, I've photographed you, it's at least three times.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I've photographed you. What's on that cup there?
What's that?
Oh, home ground,
home
yes.
Ground.
Yeah,
so
that was my thing. Yeah, I did. I programmed that through lockdown. As we were coming out of lockdown, 2021. And I did two things. Well, I mean, that was my coming out of lockdown as well, because I think home ground started in, did it start in May?
It was something like that, yeah, and it went throughout the summer.
I started at a similar-ish residency, but not quite as...
Tell us about Homeground for those listening who won't know about Homeground.
So Homeground, the concept, the people at home, Kevin Jameson came to me and said, we'd really like you to do something at home to kind of get people going back out. You know, we were kind of trying to tease people back into the land of hospitality and entertainment. So they came to me and said, we want to do something with you to encourage people to come back out, and we have this budget, we'd like you to do a season, curate a season of entertainment, and what would you like to do, and this is your budget, and you know, whatever. And they said, you can do it all yourself if you want, if that's how you see it taking shape, or you can do something completely different. So go away and think about it and then come back and tell us what you want to do. And I thought, you know, for sure, I've gone like over a year, we're into year two of not earning a bean.
Yeah.
And, you know, the option was there for me to just do the big I am. You know, this is my party of me, and I'm going to play all the records all the time, and I'm going to bore everybody to death for 3 months.
Yeah.
But then I thought, there's lots of my friends that also haven't earned a bean.
Yeah.
That are also going to really struggle to get back on the ladder.
Yeah.
Because it's one thing saying that we've come out of it and nobody's had any work, but then we're all in the same boat for sure, but then we're all in the same boat for however few jobs there are coming back out of it. And in order to get those jobs, people have to be aware of you, like visibility. So I thought, even though it meant that the budget was split and we weren't really going to earn a huge amount of money for doing it, I thought it made a lot more sense to do a shop window event for people, that so that if they were looking at what was going on in Manchester at any given week, first of all, they knew all the DJs that were going to be part of this project for the duration. And then every week we had like a schedule of, you know, which DJs were playing on the Bruntwood stage at home ground.
And you're right, it was like a shop window.
It's a shop window.
I mean, just to illustrate for people who maybe listen to this and they're not in Manchester, but next to Home Arts Centre, there's a piece of ground which is now being massively developed, and it's probably a few stories
high.
Yeah.
But at that point in 2021, it was just flat, and it was waiting to be a building site. And so this was a way to have socially distanced
entertainment.
Yeah. And there was theatre, there was a production of Midsummer Night's Dream, and there was another one as well, which I can't quite remember.
I took my son to see Shlomo, the beatboxer. Yeah. He did a family show.
Yeah, because they had two stages on the site. So one was more theatre, entertainment, cabaret, and then I took the second stage, which was... I took the DJ part of the second stage. The second stage was music.
Yeah.
So you had live music, bands, you know, brass, singers, Brazilian percussionists, all sorts of performers were on that stage. And I took the slot for the closing slot for the DJs. And in that slot, I chose 50 DJs for 50 weeks.
Yeah.
So it was different DJ every week, a different Manchester DJ who was going to just play what they played so people could remember who they were, what they did, and they got a bit of sunshine in social media and the posters and that kind of thing. And it was just basically about putting people back to work. Putting myself back to work and putting my friends back to work, because encouraging people to come out and hear music
again. Absolutely,
because around was like, people, not just in the kitchens,
blinking into the sunlight. Yeah, at that point.
And it was totally that.
Yeah, before we take you back in time and find out a bit more about your influences and things. Just going back to the book, it is a cliche question, but I am interested in the answer. Why now? What prompted you? Right, now's time for the book.
Time to write a book.
Yeah.
I was asked to write it. I didn't pitch anybody. They came to me.
But you could have said no. What were you thinking?
But I wouldn't say no, because first of all, I'm a writer at heart. It's
okay.
Something I've done from being very little. It's why I did my degree in English. It's why I've been a copywriter for years. Mm. I'm a writer.
Mm.
I am a writer. You know, I might be a DJ, but there are lots of other bits.
Well,
about
your time in music
that,
PR as well.
Yeah,
you don't get success at that by not being able to write.
Yeah, you need to be able to write. Right. So I'm
you're not telling me you're a multifaceted human, are you?
aren't most women. Aren't most women. Yeah, they are. Well, aren't most people, full stop. I mean, aren't most northern people. Yes. You know, we know how to multitask here.
Yeah, you do.
But the commissioning editor had been watching what I did through lockdown, through my website, blogs, panels I was doing, poetry I was writing, you know, all sorts of things. He'd kind of become aware of me, and he sent me an email and said, do you fancy having a chat? And he didn't say about what particularly, but once we got into the meeting, he's like, well, have you ever thought about writing a book? You know, of course I have. I've been writing, but it had always been, you know, whatever I'd written up until that point and had shown people, thinking, oh, there's a book in this, most people had rejected it or laughed at it or, you know, criticised it for one reason or another, some good, some not so fair.
Yeah.
But I'd continued to write. So he asked me if I would like to write a book. And I'm like, yeah, of course. This is really, you know, that this is a dream of mine. It's a goal of mine, you know, bucket list tick. Mm. You know, everybody says, and I say in the book, everybody says that you've got one book in you. Mm. And
interesting.
Why not, you know, why not explore that for me?
Mm.
So having never done it before, like most things, I said, yeah, you know, because there's another side of it that I think people aren't necessarily aware of. Publishing, like practically every other discipline in the entire working world, is very white-oriented. And getting a commission for a book written by a black person and then a black woman and then a black queer woman is rare. Really, really rare. So if somebody offers it, if somebody comes out of the blue, drops out of the sky and said, have you ever thought about writing a book? And if you've ever had even the tiniest thought about doing it, you're not gonna say, oh no, actually I'm a bit too busy, it's lockdown and I'm like painting my nails. Mm. Of course I'm going to say yes. You know, these chances do not come very often. So why now? Because the opportunity arose. And it was, you know, now or never. And it kind of forced me to write the book I'd always wanted to write.
Good.
You know, rather than putting it off and thinking, oh, well, such and such says they don't like it and such says that I can't write. Suddenly, I had to write a book because I said I would.
Yeah. Yes, that's great. You went yes and then thought, oh, hang
and
on.
I said yes.
I'm going to have to do this.
Yeah.
Okay.
And also, I set myself a really ambitious deadline. Pardon me. Because when he came to me to offer me, first of all, to work on the commission, we didn't know whether they were going to accept it yet.
Ah, right. Okay.
So, I mean, this is the process of books. Yeah. So we come to you and say, right, write the commission, and then they pitch it, and then they have to pitch it to two or three different sets of committees. Yeah. It goes through three committees before it gets
commissioned. It's a hell of a process.
It's
yeah, it's
a
not
long,
easy.
So by the time it came through and it's like, we've got it cleared. The first time they presented it, it didn't get cleared. And the second time, after rewriting and reshaping and whatever the pitch, this is just the pitch, then it got accepted. And then he said, so when do you think you'll be able to get the manuscript to us? So I was like, well, it's December now, so, you know, why not a year? Because we were in lockdown.
Yeah.
So I thought,
so is this 2020?
This was 2021.
21.
We were still kind of in lockdown then. So I'm like, I've got loads of time.
I think I'm plenty of time.
So he's like, right, okay then. So delivery day, 6th of December, 2022. And then I think it was November, first of all, when they said that we weren't going to come out of lockdown. And then, because there was this kind of middle kind of ground where maybe we weren't going to get Christmas and New Year. There was a moment where it was like, maybe we're not going to get Christmas and New Year again this year. Yeah. And then they released it and said,
yeah, you can.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, we can. It's all systems go. And then I thought, shit.
I better do this.
Because it meant the chocks were off.
Yeah.
It meant all of a sudden, like, the one thing I hadn't factored in was working that year.
As well.
I hadn't factored in DJing every weekend. I hadn't factored in the radio station being back. I hadn't factored any of that in. I just, for my deadline, I'd set my deadline as if I was sitting on my backside at home all day with loads of time to kill. This book was written on trains, in hotel rooms, in festival green rooms. I was like, every single spare second I could get in between playing records and sleeping, that's how this book came about. It wasn't like Victoria, like Virginia Woolf, in a room of her own, in a tiny little garret, a room and a typewriter and a table and a chair. I did not have that luxury of writing.
And it's
every single opportunity.
It's funny the way you've spoken about it and saying that you were asked, and when an opportunity for a black female queer DJ, you know, comes along, I wanted to say, well, it's really important. It's important that we hear from you. And on the first page of the book, if I just mention some names who wanted to hear this book, you think, why was it, you know, why has it taken so long? So you've got Lem Sisse, Maxine Peake, Craig Charles, Simon Dunmore, Ariel Free, Rowetta, Andy Burnham.
Yeah.
Yeah. These are not just like, who are those people? Yeah. These are people going, yes, yeah, about time.
Yeah.
It's about time.
Yeah.
This is important.
Yeah.
We need to hear this story.
Yeah, and there's so many more as well that have come.
I'm sure.
And given the most glowing endorsements for the book. I think in a way it's a counterbalance to having spent years actually, when I've been pitching stuff, being told no, that my story wasn't relevant, it wasn't rock and roll enough, it wasn't sexy enough, there wasn't enough drugs, there wasn't enough, you know, private jets, or, you know, I don't live like
so unrealistic.
The high life of a DJ, but no, I mean, it's realistic for some DJs, you know, David Guetta, private jet, Armin van Buuren, private jet, everywhere, you know, their carbon footprint is absolutely horrific, you know, these guys do not get an Uber or the Met, you know, they don't even know where the underground station is, so, you know, it's possible to write that all bells and whistles book, and I don't have that, so the relevance has always been a challenge. But the point, like the turning point for me when I was discussing the book with my commissioning editor, Tom Dart, was when I said, context is everything. And how I wanted to frame the story was to put it in the middle of everything that was happening all around it.
Yeah.
So I mentioned Section 28. I mentioned James Anderton because that's when I started.
Yeah.
And that's the environment that I started to DJ in. There weren't really any women DJing in Manchester. And in terms of the UK, I could probably count the female DJs that were getting any sunshine on two hands. You know, so I was putting everything into a more socio-cultural and historic perspective.
Yeah.
And also in terms of the way the technology developed between 1994 and 2023, I wanted to look at that. It has changed, it's evolved.
Massively. You know,
and really place myself and all of my friends and all the people that I worked with in that story of the evolution of electronic dance music and the evolution of events. You know, when we started, it was like a laugh with our mates, putting on a great party, filling the hacienda, fantastic. But we weren't thinking of it in the terms of people are thinking about it now. 12,000 people at the drum sheds, tickets selling out for Park Life, 80,000 tickets in 72 minutes.
We should just go back to the very beginning. Just we're not going to talk all the way through the book.
Oh, absolutely. Well, no, but this is gig stories.
Yeah, this is. Yes. This is. And basically, I was very surprised to read that your first ever gig was, it could well have been on the day you were born.
Yeah.
That could have been your first gig.
Well, it was. It was.
Tell us, explain that. Explain.
Me and my twin were rolling and tumbling around my mum's belly when she was singing on stage at the Free Trade Hall, December 22nd, 1966. And my mum finished her set as the consummate professional that she is and then walked out the back and got into an ambulance.
That is mad.
Or rather, actually, it would have been the 21st.
That is mad. And then you were born on the 22nd.
And then we were born on the 22nd.
So you could have been
in the morning.
Yeah. That, so that could have been your first.
What was your mum singing?
My mum sings jazz cabaret, jazz standards cabaret. She had a band called The Prophets, and you know, everything from Tina Turner covers to Ella Fitzgerald to Aretha Franklin, Mahalia Jackson. My mum's fabulous singer, she is amazing. So me and my twin were giving the, you know, we were keeping time. We were keeping time, kicking her in there.
You were
in there everywhere, kicking her in all the major organs.
Yeah.
So were you able to?
I was playing the xylophone on her ribs, apparently, because I was lying the wrong way around.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Beat mixing on.
No, I was just like, is this a harp?
So
playing with a ribcage.
Being born to that. Are you actually able to pinpoint the time that you fell in love with music?
I've always been in love with music. And I would say that it's a very strange thing because there are songs... And I do believe in the thing that if you play music to babies in vitro, that they they are aware of the vibrations and everything, you know... Because you know how music passes through water, you can see it, it vibrates, you know.
Absolutely.
That's there's why, no question about that.
That's why 3-4 rhythm is so satisfying, is because it almost
mirrors the heartbeat.
But mirrors the heartbeat, and that's really satisfying for me to know.
Yeah.
I love that. 3-4, there's something quite comforting about a 3-4 rhythm.
Yeah, lilting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I would say, so most definitely, I've been aware of it before I even got here. You know, there are songs that I know, like, note for note, cadence for cadence, that my mum sang. I don't have them in my collection. My mum sang them regularly. I don't have them in my collection, and I know them word for word.
Yeah.
And it's a weird thing, you know, I'll hear a song on the radio, and I'm like, how do I even know this? And then my mum will say, oh, well, I used to sing that all the time. So it's, you know, I think most definitely through my mum, as soon as I landed, and I landed in my really dramatic diva style with a cord tied around my neck.
Custard.
Like, ta-da! I always wear scarves. It's a thing. It's how I arrived.
That's pretty dark, isn't it? That's pretty...
Why change habit of a lifetime?
Yeah, exactly.
No, but I do. My neck's really sensitive, so I always wear scarves, and I think it's down to that. But anyway, diva. And I'm proud of that.
Good.
Why not? And then as soon as I got out, then all of my family are into music, collecting records, playing records, singing, choirs, musical instruments, whatever. So as soon as I got out and into the house, there's music in the house non-stop.
Yeah.
Someone was always playing music. We always had the radio on. If my mum needed to go out, she'd always leave me and my twin in the buggy with the radio in between us.
Oh, I love that.
So there are songs I also know from hearing them on the radio on repeat. And I know which ones they are, because it's funny, because me and my twin used to sit and we'd like be upset because my mum had gone out and all my sisters and my eldest sisters would be doing whatever around the house, supposedly looking after us, flap all, you know, it's like leaving the twins in the big silver cross thing with the radio in between
silver
us.
Cross.
And then, so Paula and I would start crying, and then there'd be a song on the radio and we'd tune in. We'd tune up or down to whichever song was in the radio and we'd start crying in tune. And then we'd listen to the song and we'd stop crying. And both of us remember doing that.
Really?
Both of us remember doing that. And that's like an awareness of music and tuning and tonality and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Which comes from my mum.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Which was then like honed listening to the radio.
Really incredible.
And then,
that
and
is
then
the most
my
mum
was like, you know, with as with all our family, it's like, put your kids on the stage. So she'd be doing shows at the West Indian Centre and it's like, oh well, Lisa can do this, Audrey can do that, you know, just filling out the schedule, like, who don't I need to pay, so I'll, like, put my children on this.
So you've
and
always
we've
been
always
performers,
been performing.
Then.
I've been performing since I've been, like, able to walk.
Now, did that translate then into, so,
lip syncing to tracks while I'm DJing, yes.
Yeah, but did that also then move into, did your, was your dad around? You mentioned your mum.
Yeah, my dad.
So
but,
were they...
but my dad was a musical. My dad is tone deaf. He couldn't carry tune in a paper bag. But but he also loved music. My dad loved Victor Moen. So he had his music.
But did they then start going to, were you aware of them? Not just your mum performing, because she was obviously
mum
a performer.
Mum and dad owned a nightclub in Manchester.
Ah, right, okay. But did they go to live gigs? So
yeah,
were you of them
did.
Going, can you remember them saying, oh, we've seen this
no.
artist or that artist?
No,
or...
no, I don't really remember them talking about gigs per se. Not my parents, but my sisters and my brother
Ah,
did.
Interesting.
And it's a funny one, this, actually, because Elizabeth, who is 3 years older than me and Paula, so we're the youngest three in the family. And Elizabeth would go to gigs, whether it was Earth, Wind and Fire or Michael Jackson or Tina Marie. And then she'd come back and she'd act it all out.
I'd like to have been there for the
for
Michael Jackson
us
one.
So that we could see, you know, because we were too little to go.
Yeah.
So that we could get something of what she'd seen, of the magic that she'd seen. And she used to, you know, whenever she'd go to a gig, she'd come home and perform
it
all for us.
So it was literally...
I mean, Elizabeth's incredible because she can copy anything.
Or she a mimic?
She can do accents.
Brilliant.
She can do, like, singing tonality. She can sing like people. Used to have that as well. We could sing like certain singers, and we had that gift.
So this was
going
to be impossible for you to not go to gigs, because you were literally your mum was performing, your sister was performing gigs for you.
I loved gigs.
Funny.
So what would,
and also, my sister Rhonda used to work at the Apollo, and Jenny worked at the Apollo, and she still does. So we could get into gigs, you know.
So what was your first gig then? Not seeing your mum perform.
Here we go.
My first gig, and this is a good one actually, because I think my first gig was either Gary Newman or Ultravox.
Early 80s. Why them?
Because I loved them and my other sisters weren't into that. I was into electronic music, 13, 14, 15, Bauhaus. Was it Bauhaus? No, Gary Newman was first, Ultravox, Japan.
This is mad.
Who else? Who did I see before I saw Bauhaus? I didn't get to see David Bowie, though. That was, like, I missed that gig. Serious Moonlight Tour. All my other friends went, and I just didn't have the money for the ticket and the trip. So I couldn't make it, and that has stuck in my craw. And why I haven't managed to see him after then, I don't know. But,
yeah, that happens. You know. Well, I only got to see him once, and that was...
I've got all the albums.
Yeah, I saw him headline Glastonbury, the 2000s.
Yeah, incredible. And that was such a set.
That blew me away, because if I'm not mistaken, I think he started with Wild as the Wind.
Yeah.
And I don't think he'd even played that for ever. And I was just like, oh, this guy's serious, isn't he?
So I think, definitely...
So you think it's one of those?
I think it was Gary Newman.
Can you remember how it felt? Can you remember the buzz that you got?
Yeah, I do. I do, and I remember putting on a suit so I could be like him.
Like Gary?
Yeah.
Yes.
And I went to see Gary Newman a few times, actually. I am a big fan of Gary Newman, so not even joking, I still am. Mm. I still follow.
He's doing an acoustic tour, isn't he?
He's incredible. He is
Which blows my mind.
I mean, for me, like, that is formative years of me buying records and trying to look like the stars that I follow. And it's a funny one, this, actually, because I was on the voting panel for the Ivor Novellos in the noughties. I can't remember what year it was. It might have been, I can't remember whether it's 2001, whichever year that Gary Newman won an award and Kate Bush also won an award the same year, and they're two heroes of mine. Heroes. And I was almost like apoplectic in the room. I'm in the middle of Gary Newman on that table, Kate Bush on that table. They both won an award, and this is just blowing my mind. So Gary Newman comes off stage after he's got this award, and everyone's like, flies around him. And I managed to get up front, and I wanted to ask him to sign something, and I just didn't have a pen and didn't have anything to sign, and all I managed to get out was, I am a real fan of yours. You have no idea how difficult your makeup was to copy for a black kid. And he just looked at me like that. There was nothing to say. But it's true. It's true.
But there's loads in that, and I think he must have loved that.
But musically, for me, Gary Newman and the synthesizers, Human League, early Human League, Travelogue Reproduction, those are my albums. You know, really? I had Dare as well, yes. Dare, the first album. I think I got the one after that as well, but not really my thing, that second one. But Dare was okay. But for me, Human League was like Martin Ware, Ian Craigmarsh and Phil Oakey. That, like, the original conception of the Human League.
Yeah.
I think I went to see them. Yes, I did. I went to see them live at the Apollo.
Oh, man.
Human League.
Yeah. It was in the 80s.
Gig, Japan, in the 80s.
I would love to do the actual
pinnacle of all of those bands, Duran Duran the same, and Spandau. So I saw all of them live. And, that was, for a long time, you know, before I started going to clubs, I was at gigs, and I was there, and I saw practically everyone I was following. I saw Soft Cell, saw them, and was buzzing. Like, we'd just be hiding, like, because I didn't... Either I had a ticket, and it was, like, a backstage ticket, so I'm kind of, you know, like you do, hiding... Yeah. But watching the gig.
And was that because your sister?
Yeah, my sister worked there, so they know. Or I didn't have a ticket and they just sneak me in when everyone went.
So you didn't do a Johnny Marr, because I know that he used to climb up and through the toilet window.
Oh, did he do that? Oh, no, we did that.
Johnny did.
We did that in the cinema. We didn't do it at the Apollo.
We did that in the cinema. We didn't do it at the Apollo.
We used to stay in the cinema. We used to go in the cinema, pay first time, and then hide in the toilets until it started again, and then we'd go back in.
Yeah.
So live gigs, then.
So my life was spent in between live gigs and the cinema, so I can talk about cinema with exactly the same fluidity as I can talk about music.
Brilliant. That's another podcast.
Yeah.
When did you then think, I love this live gig lark, how do I become more of a part of it?
I didn't have to think about that because I was always a part of it. I told you, my mum was like, get on the stage, so we didn't really have any choice. And then at school,
but DJing though,
DJ's different.
We know you for DJing, we don't know you for being
DJing because I just had lots of records.
But
I hadn't planned to do it.
So, was that a
I was a clubber,
your mates' parties?
But no, one of my friends knew somebody else. I mean, we've skipped a big bit, but one of my friends, I mean, this is kind of the beginning of me and my husband splitting up, because it was his idea actually for me to go out with this friend, and we went to the number one club, blah 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 blah, and whatever happened, it's in the book. I'm not going to give it away.
No, don't.
But I started first of all dancing in nightclubs and then became a bit of a face on the scene. And because I've become a bit of a face on the scene, my friend Tommy said, oh, well, why don't you speak to Adele, because she's putting on a party at the number one and she can't afford a DJ. And I've told her you've got lots of records, which I did. I had loads of records because I've been buying records since I've been like yay big.
Yeah.
And I had a collection of all sorts of stuff, hip hop, disco, funk, soul, you name it, rare groove, or, you know, it's an early house.
Okay.
So Larry Heard and all sorts of bits and pieces, like you do, like you build a collection. And so I met Adele and we had a chit chat and she's like, yeah, come and play. I'll pay you 30 quid and you can.
What?
In 1992, that was a lot of money.
Yeah, no.
It was decent.
Yeah. I'm like, that was a lot of money.
And
especially not having
she
done
said,
before.
Come and play. I'd never played before. I didn't even have decks at home. I didn't have any equipment. I had records, but I didn't have any equipment. I didn't have any headphones. I had to get a headphone. So I spent my entire grant for the term on vinyl, headphones, record box, you know, everything I thought that I would need. And to supplement what I already had. And I fell into DJing, but I fell in love with it from the first time that I did it, because I knew, having never done it before, I knew first of all that I loved it, that I thought it was fantastic, and second of all that I was good at it because nobody left.
That's cool.
And absolutely. I'd never done it before, and people stayed and partied and had a good time, and we had really good feedback from it. And
did it give you that same buzz as going to live gigs?
Yeah, it did. And even though it was smaller, it was still, you know, the energy was there, and it was it was like a family party, but with a load of people that you'd never met before.
Yeah.
That by the end of the party, they were like family, and that's what clubs are like anyway. You know, you go there and you enjoy the music with lots of people that you've never met before. And sometimes at gigs, you'll meet people and start talking, and then by the end of the gig, you're exchanging numbers. And like by the end of the club night, you're exchanging numbers, or at least saying, "Oh, are you coming next week?"
Yeah.
And that's how it works. It's like a really beautiful community building exercise. And I just knew I loved it. And I knew from the first one I did that I was going to do it again. I didn't know how it was going to pan out. But I knew this was an alternative for me to singing in bands and getting fired. Because I then became the engineer of my own creation. Nobody could fire me if I was DJing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And nobody could tell me what to do because I made the decision. So in a very considered way, it was like, actually, do you know what I saw on the first time that I was DJing? I saw it as an alternative to performance. I saw it as an alternative to singing, and my ex-husband didn't see that. And I was like, no, this is like the same. Yeah. It's the same as singing on a stage, is DJing, playing music to lots of people on a dance floor. It's the same thing. And he couldn't see it as the same thing. And I was like, this is the future.
Yeah.
It was that's a different podcast. But I'm fascinated because I felt like I was able to
experience. We've had three different podcasts, by the way. Write down the ideas. Yeah, trademark it.
Because I feel in the 90s was the change from going to nightclubs, but then going to nightclubs specifically for a DJ. But then the change again.
Superstars.
But there was sort of an in-between bit where I would be going to more of a gig venue rather than a nightclub. So I remember going to the Cardiff Uni to see CJ Bolland.
Yeah.
And...
because and they realised sort of that it had gone beyond the because it had gone beyond the rave, it had gone beyond the club, that we could actually fit more people in.
And it was a gig.
Yeah.
It wasn't a nightclub. Yeah. We were going to see CJ Bolland play 60 to 90 minutes, just like a band would, rather than 2 hours at 11 p.m. in a...
Yeah.
No, we were going...
Well, because the closing times were different for those places, and the licensing times were different for those places, so you get a 90-minute set rather than a two-hour or a three-hour set, because they, you know, like places like the Apollo and the Ritz, they have to be closed at midnight.
So what was your first...
The licensing finishes... You can sell your last... beer or something at 11:30 in the olden days. Mm. So the licensing has changed slightly.
Well, I think because there's so much packed into this book and into your life, I feel like we are inevitably going to miss things and jump past things.
Yeah.
But you mentioned about the licensing, and one of the, you know, everyone when they talk about Manchester clubs, they talk about Hacienda, and I think it's kind of inevitable that we would do. But in terms of flesh, how the environment at that time, you're talking about James Anderton, the police chief,
really anti-gay, Section 28. You couldn't even talk about anything same sex.
You've got the AIDS in crisis the press, at that point as well.
In schools, it was almost like a book burning. You know, you couldn't discuss anything gay. But out of that, flesh was born out of that really negative crucible in a way. And what came from it was, we're out, we're proud, we're here, and we're also young, old, we're mixed, black, white, you name it. We are going to put something in the middle of Manchester, in the middle of the biggest club in the city, because also gay anything clubbing was very much on the outskirts and... on the outside, we were putting it, but also we were doing it on a weeknight. So it was the last Wednesday of every month, not even the Thursday, so you could kind of fiddle a day off.
Middle of the week.
Middle of the week, we all have it. And it was full every month. It was packed to capacity every month.
Well,
it made money. And we got a late license.
And that was the
Paul Cons got the first late license that had ever been given to any establishment in Manchester.
And I'd love
4 o'clock in the morning. And the reason why, well, I mean, this is like Peter Hook thinking that the reason why was like five members of the committee that needed to pass that license were gay. So here we go.
Yeah.
And also what Flesh did, it, like, the Hacienda had not had a gay night in the entire first 9 years of its existence.
Yeah.
So this was there in the year it came back, because it had been closed for a year.
Mm.
Remember?
That's right, yeah.
So the Hacienda had been closed for a year. It came back with a fresh coat of paint, a fresh attitude to clubbing, and also a more open and accepting attitude to a section of the community that had been almost a pariah two years before. And what Flesh managed to do out of that was attract a really positive press attention as well. So Gay Chester came out of it. That term Gay Chester came from Paul Cons, who developed the Flesh Party, and the phrase "It's queer up north" was Flesh. And it attracted gay tourism from all over the world, not just London, not just Sheffield, but it was all over the world. Suddenly Manchester became a mecca for gay pride, and that is a phenomenal achievement. And I wanted to make it clear that of all the things that the Hacienda is famous for, and you will still, every time I do an interview, people want to talk about the drugs, the gangs, the this, the, you know, the darkness. That is real. But there was also a very bright, positive side that they don't talk about, because it made lots of money. It kept the Flesh, kept the Hacienda going. Financially,
which
kept
is unbelievable.
The Hacienda going.
And but also changed the landscape of clubland in Manchester. Yeah.
That late license had never been done before. Once that happened, it opened the floodgates for everyone else. So Paradise Factory, Manto's Bar, Canal Street, everybody else could then apply.
And I genuinely, not patronising, what an amazing thing to have been part of.
It was.
You witness that and
like
just think,
buzzing every day thinking
happened?
About it. But
that
then,
actually happened.
But then when it was happening, I don't think any of us were aware of the legend that it would become.
I was just going to say, I bet you had no
and
idea.
And I think Dave Haslam says the same, Graham Park says the same, of when they were playing at the Hacienda. It was great. It was a phenomenal party. But the legend, you know, the thing about legends is they come into existence because that thing doesn't exist anymore. So James Dean, Marilyn Monroe, you know, it's like, because they're not here anymore. So that, you know, even Princess Diana, that presence gets bigger year on year on year, because we don't get to see them grow old, we don't get to see them fail, we don't get to see them kind of lose any of their cachet. They've gone at the absolute pinnacle peak of their presence or existence, and then it just goes on from that, because nobody really has, you know, all the memories are always good all the time. So the legend just feeds itself in the end.
I love that. And it's another reason, one of many, why you need to read the book.
My book!
Yeah, it's so true, it's so true. Because it's just, it's so important. It's so important to the history of music, clubbing, the progression of clubbing
society.
In Britain.
Society, because it wasn't, you know, when people think, you know, even if people talk about Flesh in 2023 and it's like, oh, it was a gay party, it's like, you have to contextualise
More than that. It was more than that.
Because in 2023, really well, you can have, you know, 2023, we've got Block 9 in Glastonbury. Block 9 wasn't developed in Glastonbury until 2008.
Yeah, no, I remember.
Flesh was 1993.
Yeah.
So we came before whatever we did, whatever trade did, whatever Queer Nation did, whatever any of those clubs in the 90s did to push the gay culture forward and get it into the kind of consciousness of anyone clubbing is a massive achievement. We created a gay club that straight people wanted to go to. In 1991, gay anything was catching. It was filth. It was puff, fag, queer. And, you know, you have to put, I don't know what you have to put, a trigger warning on that for whatever the words and terminology I used were. But in 1991, 1992, it wasn't cool to go to a gay party and what Paul Combs and Lucy shared in developing a party that people, straight people, would kiss their mates at the door to prove they were gay so they could get in, and that happened.
Yeah.
That says something about what an achievement, how big an achievement.
But do you know what? I'm just closing it so we can move on. I remember in that time, in that sort of 5-year period, any of us, because my friend Tom Churchill, bless him, and I credit him with all my love of techno music from Jeff Mills to two boys that turned into Daft Punk.
Yeah.
You know, watching them.
It was always,
we'd say, Tom, where do we need to go? Where can we hear this music? And it was always, I'm a Cardiff boy, we always had to go to the gay clubs because that
music
was
better.
That's where you're going to hear the good music. And that's it. I don't care what anyone else says. That was the deal. You wanted to hear the best techno music and the best music. It was in the gay clubs in the 90s.
Well, yeah. I won't fault you on that.
No, it's true.
That's where I started, so, you know.
Your favourite live act? Who?
This year?
What?
Any
is your,
year?
No, ever.
Prince.
Gosh, yeah, that comes up.
That's mine and, as well. Yeah.
And
Prince, without a doubt. And every time I watch Prince, YouTube, you name it, and I will put on Twitter or Instagram or wherever I'm watching it, I really miss this guy.
Yeah.
And I really do miss this guy. I'm sad I didn't see Earth, Wind and Fire.
Yeah.
I didn't see them in their early years.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I'm sad I didn't see them. I saw Trouble Funk many times and still every time I think about their gig, it their live performances anywhere, and I saw them at the Manchester International, and we went and we danced our asses off. Incredible band to see, you know, X amount of brass on stage just vibing off each other, and they never ever played for an hour. They always played longer than 2 hours, and it would be like 3 hours, and it'd be knackered. It's like, when are they gonna finish?
They shoot
horses, don't they? And they're incredible. But Prince also had that, you know. Prince's live, you know, like you say, people who don't rehearse, his band changed their set every night, and they were tight, and he could change the set list.
He'd sound check the entire band. He'd sound check everything.
And
that's mad.
And just such a perfect performer.
Mm.
Just an incredible performer, incredible songwriter. He wrote, you know, much like Stevie Wonder. I've seen Stevie Wonder, incredible. Mm. Like, and Stevie Wonder is my absolute number one influence person.
Amazing.
We're not here forever, but when Stevie Wonder goes, don't call me, I am painting my house black.
Yeah.
But, because I suffered when Aretha went, and she was my number one singer. And when Stevie goes, do not call me.
I
love Stevie Wonder live, but Prince, number one.
Right, so I'm not one to push our podcast too hard, but I must recommend you listen to our last episode, but the one before that was Dr. Susan Rogers, and she produced Purple Rain.
Okay.
And
happily.
Around the World in 80 Days.
I'll happily listen to
all of them.
Yeah, yeah.
She's incredible. Musicologist, talks about why we enjoy the music that we enjoy.
Yeah.
What the processes are mentally.
But also her stories with Prince.
Oh, but just meeting Miles Davis and all this kind of stuff.
God, I mean,
it's
mad.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a hard question, because I would say, I've seen so many people live that have blown me away. I mean, I ask another question.
Right.
Yeah, don't say anything, because I like that. No, you've gone with Prince. I like it.
Your favourite ever gig. So this might be him as well. So
a single gig.
It might not be.
Yeah.
Because one of my abiding memories is taking my twin, I don't even know how I managed to engineer this, because we didn't pay for a ticket, but I organised it. Taking my twin to see Run DMC and the Beastie Boys at the Apollo.
In Manchester.
For that really big tour, you know, with the hydraulic.
Yes.
And the girls in the cages.
Yeah. Because the Liverpool one, that's the one that had the riots.
Yes.
Yes.
And Manchester was.
And then there's the Manchester one.
Controlled. And we were at that gig at the front. And we left there absolutely drenched. It was fantastic.
Your ears must have been.
That I would.
I loved I would that have gig killed. And I can remember it so. Clearly, it was brilliant.
I would kill to have been at that gig. I've still never seen Run DMC because they had to cancel Kendall Calling.
Yeah.
And
shame.
I managed to see the Beastie Boys.
Shame.
Who are just. Yeah.
Beastie Boys are just.
They were incredible.
Because with the Beastie Boys, it was the start of actually there being really fierce white rappers who were kind of taken over. Hip hop was very much black, you know.
It
told the story. It was a black history thing.
Yeah.
And then for the Beastie Boys to come in and be, you know, they had, you know, whatever their team was behind them, but
it's a funny one because as they were trying. They were doing their sort of more puerile stuff, daft stuff.
Yeah, they started off like
kids, and then you but had and they were up against the absolute powerhouse and God and my hero, Chuck D and Public Enemy.
Yeah,
and you're like, hang on.
Yeah, I mean the two different stories.
These white
there.
Jewish, apparently Jewish kids, they're never gonna do it. But then all of a sudden
they did, because they stopped being stupid.
Yes,
they
get to Paul's boutique and on, and then you were like,
they stopped being stupid.
Oh my gosh.
They started being aware.
They are these kids
they
are serious.
Being aware. They started making real, proper music and not...
Do you know what I love about that answer is that, not just because the gig itself, but because it involved your sister.
Yeah,
and it's a memory that's intrinsically linked
with... I did a lot of gigging with my twin, actually, and then I did a lot of gigging on my own, but, yeah, and I still go to clubs now. You know, my twin sometimes accompanies me on a mission.
I like that. I like that.
What's it's your... a family thing, though, isn't it?
Relates
still
to that.
Still go to gigs with lots of members of my family. It was great going to see Kamasi Washington with my sister Alicia, and I go to festivals with Alicia and Elizabeth and Paula. And yeah,
do you know what? I was just
still do.
I was just telling Chris earlier. Just I've been away working for a few weeks, and so it'll have been a month ago now. And me, my wife, and Grace and George, my two kids, we all. Went to see Little Sims together.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, are you going to ask me about what gigs in 2022, 2023 have blown me away? Because I did.
Were you at that one at
Little Sims
just now?
Yeah.
And I was saying to Chris, what's funny is my.
And Royal Carna at Glastonbury. And
we
I
were
was
there for
there
that.
In
yeah,
the
were you? So was I. So was I with my with
and
Grace
watching
and George.
Royal Carna start with like. 3-4 rows of people and then take over West Holt. So by the end of it,
it was rammed.
There was nobody else anywhere. Loyal Carna had everyone, and I'm texting Jam Supernova going, oh my God, I've just seen Loyal take over.
I just want to hug you because it was the best.
Yeah.
And George was stood on a bin.
Loyal was incredible.
And in fairness, we.
He didn't put a foot wrong for that.
No,
set,
he didn't.
Actually. He
but
really
we'd seen
did.
Him for. Years and years, a friend of mine put me on to Loyal, early doors, and I remember taking people to see him in one of the small tents at Kendall Calling, which would have been 2017?
Yeah. But then
something
again,
like that.
Kraftwerk
and
at Blue Dot, they were incredible.
Oh, so
good.
Yeah, shit. No, look, and I can't wait... for Loyal Carna at Castlefield
next
year.
Yeah, that's going to be amazing.
Oh, it's going to blow my mind. It's going
and
to blow
Jungle
my mind.
At Castlefield, they will be incredible.
Yeah, I love that new album.
Volcano, it's amazing.
It's brilliant.
It's amazing. It's one of my albums of the year, Volcano.
Definitely, definitely.
Yeah.
What's your worst ever gig, either as a DJ or as a punter?
You you know, I have to be honest and say, was it Beanie Man at Glastonbury this year?
This year?
No. Who was the reggae guy that was on this year? Really huge reggae artist. And, you know, I've blanked his name because he was so... His patter on the stage was really disappointing. He talked about, I'm not doing a full set. They asked me to come out here and do a full set of all my classics. And he just kind of sang an extended dub loop of one track for about 15 minutes. And then he was like talking about how they'd booked him and how much they'd paid him. And I was like, why are you doing this?
You don't show how the sausages are made.
Why are you doing this? And also he was moaning and he's standing on West Holt's, a stage which the day before I'd watched Loyal Kana start with two rows of people and then just build the crowd.
Amazing.
So it was incredible.
We'll find out
Third World were brilliant. They were in the day and they even had, like, he sang opera. That was incredible. Like, it was amazing. Third World was incredible.
That's where your man played as well.
Jacob Collier.
Brilliant.
West Holt's
was a great stage.
Is one of my favourite stages ever.
Great stage.
I think I've said on here one of my favourite moments of all time, when it used to be called Jazz World Stage, was Massive Attack playing that stage.
You know they're doing
with orchestra.
They've got some big gigs.
They're playing in Bristol next year.
And it's going to be like the lowest carbon emissions of any gig ever.
Yeah. And I'm like, I might need to drive to that gig.
But then Soul are playing at the Drum Sheds on the 14th of December, and it sold out in seconds. £99 a ticket, but it sold out in seconds. 12,000 tickets.
Favourite venue?
Yeah, favourite venue. This would be interesting.
I'm a bit biased, really, but I love the Albert Hall, although I don't... Mm-hmm. The thing I don't love about it is that sitting upstairs in that mezzanine is really painful. I think they need more padding for the album.
It's very churchy,
cheeks.
Isn't it?
Yeah, but
that wood on the album cheeks is not comfortable.
But
I am always shifting about. But
the sound is unreal.
But for a live band, Albert Hall is just the right size to get the right sound.
Yeah,
I said it on here that her Little Sims, not this tour, the tour before, which is sort of 2 years ago, she did Albert Hall, and that is one of my favourite gigs of all time.
Yeah, see, I would say for there, I've heard Kamasi Washington play there a couple of times, and incredible. I like Thundercat as well at the Gorilla.
You saw Thundercat at Gorilla?
Yeah.
Oh, that makes me want to cry.
Yeah, that was sick.
Normally with a podcast episode, I will make up a playlist of all the pieces of music that we've talked about, and I'll put a Spotify playlist on the page. But your page, I'm not going to do that because you made
discography in the back.
Well, I've
of
made a playlist of every single one of them, so there's 52
great.
Tracks.
Okay.
And there's some absolute bangers.
Yeah.
I noticed you put Little Sims in.
Sick, and I have actually been a bit naughty because I realised, I don't know how it happened, but I have actually missed two tracks of the discography at the back of the book. So I have added them in the Spotify thing, so people will find two rogue tracks that aren't actually on the discography, but they are in the book, and they are actually two key tracks.
Okay, do you know what?
Two key
Don't
tracks.
Don't mention them.
I'm not going to say what they are, because it's for people to find out what the difference.
Because I want people to find, in fact, I'm going to find
it.
And you can ping me on Twitter or Instagram whenever you find what those tracks are. And also, when you do find them, you'll go...
Oh, as if you left those
How
two.
Did you How'd manage you miss to that? Miss those two out? Yeah. And you'll be like,
love that. Right.
How did she doing? Do that? And when I did actually realise, I was like, no.
Please tell me it's a reefer. I'm just jumping there.
No,
that
I was
so
like,
funny.
no. How did I manage to do that? And I did try and get it put back in, but it was too late. The print had already gone.
You've heard it here first. Well, Chris is going to do that. And as always, it'll go on the website.
Great.
But our last question to everyone always is a recommendation of a live track or live bit of video, and the example we always use is Prince.
Yeah,
the live one where it's the George Harrison tribute, and he walks on, just plays that,
guitar gently weeps.
Plays that, and then walks off. So, if you could just recommend one live track,
I don't know whether it is on film or not. This is the thing, but when I went to see Stevie Wonder at Bercy in Paris, because I was living in Paris at the time.
Yeah.
Prince and Sheila Reid went on stage with him.
Came on stage with him.
And they did a couple of tracks. Now, I was wetting myself because I like Prince, Sheila Reid anyway.
Yeah.
But then Prince, Sheila Reid and Stevie Wonder, it was just like, what is going on? And the people that I'd gone to the gig with were only there because they didn't actually like Stevie Wonder, but they were there because
those people exist.
I bought, yeah, they do.
Wow.
And one, what? Anyway, long story. Long story, but they weren't really in it. So I was just like, oh my God, and screaming and running down the thing to get as close as I could to see. And they were just thinking I was a mental case for it. So if you could find that,
what year
that would
be
that amazing.
Be approximately?
Oh God, I can't remember. I'll have to do, was it 2011, 2012?
I'll get hunting.
Or 2010, 2011, around there.
Yeah.
Prince. And if not that, then there is a live of, I think, Prince singing Mountains, and Mountains is just one of my absolute favourite Prince tracks, just simply because the lyrics are great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great song.
Right.
Love will conquer if you just believe.
Exactly.
It's amazing, that track.
Right, well that'll be on your webpage.
DJ Pullet.
Sit.
The Life
Welcome
and
to the
Lessons
Club.
Of a Black Woman DJ. That the book is out now. Get it.
Yeah.
I cannot thank you enough for
You're
spending
welcome.
The time with us.
Thank you so much.
I urge all of you listening.
I'm having microphone envy. What is this?
Well, don't ask.
I called it a hippo the other day. It's not a hippo. It's a Yeti.
It's a Yeti.
Yeah.
It's a Yeti.
Is it a very expensive microphone?
It's
surprisingly
it's a
affordable
good one for podcasts.
Is it?
There we are, DJ Paulette. What an incredible woman and DJ. Just amazing.
Yeah, and as we do with every guest, there is a playlist. Now, the playlist that I put together on Spotify is normally based on pieces of music that we talk about on the episode in the conversation. But DJ Paulette has been kind enough to include a massive playlist right at the end of the book. So what I've done is I have just taken all of those tunes, put them in order, and that's what you've got. You've got, and so basically the playlist is not just the soundtrack to our podcast episode, it's the soundtrack to her book, and essentially it's a soundtrack to her life. So definitely check out that on the website, gigstoriespodcast.com.
What an eclectic playlist it is as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's cracking.
It's amazing.
So good.
I'm just going to have that playing in the house. It's
yeah,
it's incredible. And yeah, loads of love and loads of thanks to DJ Paulette.
Oh, and also a quick thank you to Michelle Nicholson, who looked after us at home. We recorded this at home in Manchester, and it's appropriate that we recorded the episode at home. If you haven't been to Home, it's an amazing multi-discipline art centre in the middle of Manchester. And DJ Paulette's book launch is actually, well, by the time this episode goes out, it's basically next week. So, yeah, get your grubby mitts on one of these books and just enjoy.
You won't regret it. I would say, for anyone who has an interest in music, it's a vital read. And I've gotten a copy, and having my son read it. So, George, now we've spoken about our kids before, and it's hilarious because for his GCSE music, George is doing DJing, producing. And Father Christmas bought him some decks.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so what I'm hearing is making me smile night after night. He's in his room creating his own music and also mixing. And for his high school Christmas show, we went along and had to listen to all the usual. And I say all the usual, slightly snarkily, because I used to be that usual. I was the one playing something terrible on my screechy violin.
Once in Royal David City by Recorder Ensemble.
That's exactly it.
Yeah.
Three-part harmony a cappella choir who weren't given a starting note.
Oh, interesting.
Bless their hearts. Bless their hearts. I felt for them. And then in the middle of that, Georgie boy.
The dry ice comes on.
Exactly right. Old not so fat boy Slim, he gets up and does a 5-minute dance classic remix set.
All the bangers.
It was absolutely brilliant. I couldn't
Did stop people smiling. Get up? Did people get up?
People were clapping and clapping along with it and getting into it. And he did this great remix of Delight's Groovers in the Heart and Gypsy Woman's La Da Dee La Da.
Oh, excellent.
Honestly, absolutely brilliant.
But then who followed it? I mean, was it then followed by Away in a Manger by the Infants or something?
Do you know what? I genuinely think it was followed by four or five flautists playing Greensleeves.
Wow. Christmas classic.
Christmas like Greensleeves. I was like,
really?
Oh, we're going there, are we?
Nice. So, well, that's great.
I know. So it's been great because I've always introduced music and always had music around the house and with my children and go to gigs with them. But specifically recently, you know, talking to George about DJs and DJing and things like that. I told him all about DJ Paulette, and he's going to have a read of the book too. So I'm excited about that. So excellent. Thank you, DJ Paulette. Thanks for being a wonderful guest. And thank you for being a wonderful interviewer, Chris, and you lot for being wonderful listeners.
Wow, I think Alex is drunk.
Just on life, Christopher.
Absolutely.
Just on life.
So we have got some more episodes coming up. We can't tell you too much about them yet, but we've got some absolute belters coming up. So stay tuned. What you can do is have a look through our previous episodes. There's a compilation episode rather recently that we put out. Just have a look at the webpage for Paulette's episode, because there are loads of videos and there's this Spotify playlist, and it just makes it a far richer experience having that in front of you and then dipping in and out between that, and get her book as well. And then it's just a surround sound of DJ Paulette. Beautiful.
Absolutely love it. And we'll see you next time on the Gig Stories podcast.
See you later.
Bye.